second villa. My wife was waiting down at the first place with the kids. The second place was nicer, but in the meantime, I'd rung the people we'd just hired the previous villa from, where we'd been staying the week before, and I asked if we could stay there for another week. It was literally down the road from the training camp, 5 minutes in the car. Carlos Quiros, United's assistant manager, arrived while I was at the second villa. Carlos is Portuguese. I think he was born in Mozambique. There was some sort of a connection with the resort people. He had organised the camp for the team. He came up and said, "That's fine." And I said, "I've just got word that we can stay in the villa we were in last week. I'll pay for it myself. I'd rather my family be comfortable while we're training." But we had a disagreement. It wasn't heated. It was just a disagreement. I knew I was there for pre-season training, but it was my wife and children's holiday. But I think Carlos might have felt a bit put out. He wasn't happy. And I knew that this would be going back to the manager. Anyway, we moved back to the villa we'd stayed in the previous week. The rest of the players came in the next day, and so did the manager. He made a big fuss about what had happened. Started ranting and raving in the dressing room after the first training session. The dressing room was empty, but all the other players were right outside. They would have been able to hear everything that was going on. "What is the big deal?" I said. I just thought it was an overreaction. "I'm just staying down the road." The way the place was set up, there was a restaurant where all the players would eat at lunchtime and the families could gather and eat there in the evenings. Ironically, I was the only player who turned up every day with his family. We were never isolated. It was a big resort. Everyone was scattered around. But something happened there. Whatever had gone on, whatever Carlos said, I don't know. Maybe he felt embarrassed. He'd organised the camp for the club. Whether they felt I'd insulted the owner somehow, I don't know. I carried on training. We trained for the week. And it was brilliant. The mix, training, then the afternoon spent with the families, was perfect. Pre-season is about training, recovery and bonding. Recovery just means relaxing after you've trained. Sitting, maybe watching TV, or if you're in a place like the Algarve, sitting by the pool. There's a discipline to that, which I probably wasn't very good at, actually resting. So having my family there was great. And the facilities were fantastic. One day the manager came onto the training pitch and said, "I need some senior players tonight." He was doing this not talking to me routine. It happened regularly, if I weren't playing a friendly for Ireland or went too soon after an injury. He wouldn't speak to me for a week or two. It was childish, but I'd probably have been the same. I'd have been annoyed with any player who I thought was risking his fitness. He didn't talk to me, so I didn't talk to him. We were both being childish. Anyway, he wanted some players to go for dinner or something with the owner of the resort. We were all there, stretching, and he was going, "Giggsy," and choosing his players and ignoring me. I was the captain and the lads were looking at me laughing. I was sitting there right in front of him. Such childish stuff. I think it was Giggsy and Gary Neville who had to go to dinner. Back in Manchester, still in pre-season, I hurt my hamstring training. I wasn't doing anything too strenuous. We were just stretching, and I felt a tweak. A badly torn hamstring is torture, but mine was just a slight tear. So I missed a couple of games and the pre-season tour of Asia. When you're a first-team player coming back from injury, you train for a while with the younger players, the reserves, to get back up to speed. You ease your way back to fitness. The reserves wouldn't be at the same level as the first team, so you don't put any extra stresses on your body. There wouldn't be the same intensity, so you can make your mistakes, get the rustiness out of you. Whereas when you go back with the first team, there are no shortcuts. There's no messing about. You'd have a game in mind in a couple of weeks, say, and you'd have a discussion with the medical staff. You'd agree a target, a timetable. As an experienced player, I knew my own body. I was ready to come back. I should be ready by Monday week. But I was being told, no, not yet. Carlos, for some reason, was reluctant to get me back into the first team. And when he eventually did, he treated me very badly. There was often a practice match at the end of training, 10v10 or 8v8. This time, I ended up being the last man standing, the last player to be picked. Carlos looked at me, and I said, "Carlos, what?" He had a bib. And I'll always remember this like it was yesterday, because I'm surprised he didn't knock him out. He just threw it at me. The other players were looking at me and he went, "Oh, you just stand up front." I was a midfielder. I didn't play centre forward. It was like he was saying, "You stand up there so you won't do any harm." That got my back up, and rightly so. But I wasn't one for arguing with staff on the training ground. I could count the number of arguments I've had with staff on the training ground on one hand. But I was thinking, am I missing something? And I concluded, probably. But I wasn't thinking of the Villa in Portugal at that time. A couple of days later, I was talking to the manager and I said, "Carlos has been a bit strange, you know. He's reluctant to get me back in the group." And the manager went, "Yeah, I know he can be a funny old sod, but leave that with me, Rye." The season started okay. We won our first three games against Everton, Villa and Newcastle, and we drew at home to Manchester City, which I would have classed as a bad result. We should always beat City at home. But then I broke my foot in a tackle at Liverpool. Stephen Gerrard stood on my foot. Gerrard was wearing those new bladed boots, and I'm convinced they did the damage. I carried on playing, but it was sore, fucking very sore. I was tackled again later by Luis Garcia, and I limped away from that one. So people often think it was Garcia who caused the injury, but it was Gerrard and his blades. I went off with a few minutes to go. Liverpool have an X-ray machine right next to the dressing room, so they X-rayed my foot and came back straight away with the news. I'd broken it in, I don't know, 5 or 6 places. So that was me out injured again. I remember thinking to myself in the dressing room, this is bad timing, for all sorts of reasons. The problem with a foot injury is that it's a dead, slow recovery. Your foot is in a medical boot, and the blood flow is slow. It's bad because there's not much you can do. You have to be very patient. It's always a 4 or 5 or 6 week job, no matter how fit you are. I'd already been injured. I was into the last year of my contract. There'd been the awkwardness with Carlos. The insecurities were queuing up. As part of our contractual deal with MUTV, United's television channel, each player had to go into a studio now and again to discuss the latest game, the match we'd just played. There was a roller of players, and my turn would come up 2 or 3 times a season. But a month after the injury, I think we were playing Spurs at home and I was supposed to cover it for MUTV, but the manager gave me a few days off. He said, "Why don't you go and get a bit of sun for yourself?" I was off the crutches at this stage, and I think the boot you wear to keep the weight off the foot might have been off by then too. So I was pretty mobile. Coincidentally, my family had already booked a holiday in Dubai before I got injured. So I just thought, the timing's perfect, I can join them. They went out a couple of days before me. I flew out alone and came back with them. A swap was done. I think with Gary Neville, who covered the Spurs game for MUTV instead of me. And the producers asked if I'd do the next game away to Middlesbrough when I get back from holiday. So I was in Dubai, getting a bit of sun and putting my foot in the salt water. I suppose I could have gone to Ireland, to y'all for that. But I was in Dubai. It's slightly more romantic. I knew the Middlesbrough game was on TV. I thought to myself, I want to watch the team anyway, and I'll be doing the analysis when I get back to Manchester. So I decided to watch it in the hotel bar. They lost 4-1. Disaster. United were awful. And that just happened to be the game I'd be doing. Fucking hell. Later on, I think, if I'd just done the Spurs game the week before, if I hadn't broken my foot, if I hadn't gone to Dubai, if United had beaten Middlesbrough, ifs and ands, pots and pans. I came back to Manchester from Dubai and MUTV people go, it's your turn. And I had to do it. United were poor. And I was disappointed with the players. But it was MUTV. It's the in-house channel, propaganda for the club. All the top clubs have channels like it. If things are going bad, they get some positive news out there. Forget about the bad result. Some young players doing well out on loan. If you got knocked out of a cup, the next day they'd announce that some player had signed a new contract or that share prices were up. That's the game. It's part of the game. I did the interview. He was poor. Poor defending. He's got to do better than that. I was annoyed, I remember. But I wasn't edgy about it. The idea that I was in the studio ranting and raving, no, it was quite calculated. The message was, we weren't good enough and we could do better. I think it was the next day I was told that the interview was being pulled and that they couldn't believe what I'd said. I was like, I don't think it was too bad. We'd lost 4-1. I couldn't say we'd played well. When we'd been beaten before, I'd often said, that wasn't good enough today. No, it was as if you weren't supposed to say that. It was all too delicate. I just thought everyone was overreacting. But the news got into the media, and I knew it didn't look good for me. People were starting to say, oh, they've had to pull this video. I'm pretty sure that someone at United leaked it. I'd insulted the team, I'd been disloyal. They were building a picture. I was this loose cannon, slagging off everybody. It was back page headlines in all the papers. When it comes to Manchester United, everything is extremes. You win a game, you're the greatest. You lose a game, you're the world's worst. But this was so over the top, it was untrue. I was looking at it going, there's something going on here. It was even more intense in Manchester, where I live, because it was about Manchester United. I couldn't help thinking, this is going to end in disaster. When I stepped out of line before, the PR people at United had always been good at managing it, giving it a bit of balance. But there was nobody giving me a dig out this time. I wasn't worried about the dressing room, because I think that players knew my form. But all sorts of stuff was coming out now that I'd spoken about players' wages, for example, something that I would never do. Usually, when there was something in the media about any of the players or a member of the staff, we'd nip it in the bud by going, listen, we're used to it. We're Man United. Everything is going to be exaggerated. It was par for the course. But this was getting a bit silly. And United had just been beaten by Lille in the Champions League, which didn't help the atmosphere. Or the manager's mood. So, eventually, I got the players together in the dressing room and I said, look lads, I need to get this off my chest. You've seen all this stuff in the media. Just to let you know, lads, that it's fucking nonsense. I would never go into stuff about players' wages or people not trying. I might say a player had a bad game, but they were all going, yeah, yeah, as they spoke. Not one of them had an issue. Not one. But at the back of my mind, part of me was thinking, what did I say in the video? I might have said something pretty bad for them to pull it. And even now, today, people still say, this video had to be destroyed. Like it was a nuclear weapon or something. Did someone drive out to the countryside and bury it in the fucking ground? Or did a bomb disposal unit come and explode it? It had to be destroyed! Anyway, by now we were talking about the quality of our game and how we'd taken our eyes off the ball a little bit. We'd had one or two bad results. It went on for about an hour. Instead of going out training, we ended up having this chat. All the players were getting involved. I've spoken to some of them about it since. And Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, who's a man I have a lot of respect for, still talks about the conversation I started that morning. About how we needed to refocus. And how we shouldn't let ourselves be distracted by the off-the-field stuff. Boot sponsors, magazine interviews, too many media commitments. And Ollie still reckons it was exactly what we'd needed. No ranting or raving. No finger-pointing. Nothing like that. And we spoke about training too. Lads, we need to sharpen up. Remember what we're about. It's about what we do. Football. Winning football matches. We've been talking for quite a while by now, maybe an hour. So I went up to the manager's office to tell him why we weren't outside training. He said, well, I'm coming down. I knew from his reaction that he wasn't happy. I went back down ahead of him and I said to the lads, I'm not sure this was such a good idea. He stormed in and said, what's this all about? And he asked me if I was going to apologise. I said, well, I've got nothing to apologise about. What about the video? And I said, I think the video's fine. And he went, I tell you what, up fucking stairs now into my office. Everyone, let's go and watch that fucking video. So I'm walking up the stairs. We're all walking up on our training kit, like a load of kids being called to the headmaster. I'm walking up and I'm thinking, here goes, because I'm still not 100% sure what I said. We watch the video. Some lads standing, some sitting down. More than 20 international footballers scattered around this massive office. This was only a couple of years after Saipan. Talk about deja vu. I'd been down this road before. I was getting used to it. We watched, and they were still thinking I could be the one in for the shock here. Oh, by the way, lads, I forgot to mention that downstairs. But it ended, and I was very relieved because it tallied with what I told the players. There were no shocks or contradictions, thank God. So I went, look, lads, have any of you got a problem? They were all, no, no, no. I said, Fletch, to Darren Fletcher. I'd said something about my wife tackling better than him for one of the goals. But I could tell from his expression that he was fine with it. Fletch knew my form. The mood was still good between me and the players. But Carlos and the manager were in the background, steam coming out of their ears. I said, lads, I told you what I said, but we got beaten 4-1, you know. And they were all, every player. No, we're okay with it. Yep, we're comfortable enough with it. But the manager went, no, it's a disgrace, this fucking video. I said, none of the players have got a problem with it. With that, Van der Sar, who'd been at the club a few months, put his hand up and said, do you know, Roy, I just think you could have used a different tone. Edwin, Dutch international, 6 million caps. So I said, Edwin, why don't you shut the fuck up? You've been at this club 2 minutes and you've done more interviews than I've done in my 12 years. It was MUTV. I had to do it. So he took that. He accepted it. But then Carlos turned and he said, you've not shown any loyalty to your teammates. He was just on my right shoulder. Oh, he didn't fucking hit him again, I was thinking. The villain Portugal not treating me well in training and he just used the word loyalty to me? I said, don't you talk to me about loyalty. Don't you fucking talk to me about loyalty, Carlos. You left this club after 12 months a few years ago for the Real Madrid job. Don't you dare question my loyalty. I had opportunities to go to Juventus and Bayern Munich. So don't you question me about loyalty. And while we're at it, we spoke about training downstairs. And we were just on about mixing things up on the training a bit. And he went, no, Roy, we need repetition. That's what we need, repetition. And I said, Carlos, do you always make love to your wife in the same position? And I think he went, what? Where is this going? I said, you change the position, don't you? Sometimes you have to mix training up a little bit. That's all I'm saying. That's coming from all the players. It's not a personal thing. I haven't a clue why I said that. And still don't. But the manager went, that's enough of that. I've had enough of all this stuff. And I said, you as well, gaffer. We need fucking more from you. And I mentioned the horse deal as well. I can't justify everything I said that morning. I was just annoyed. The manager had wanted to get us involved in a syndicate to buy a horse with him. This was a few years before. He'd taken us up to some stables on the way to Catterick, I think. We were all to put money into the syndicate, out of the players' pool. We used to earn extra money for MUTV appearances and other media work, and we put it into the pool. Christmas dues, trips to the horse race, and they were paid for from the pool. It was like a kiddie, but a pretty big one. The whole thing had annoyed me at the time, that we would have put money into the syndicate, but would only have got 1/16 between us. As it was, we never got involved in it. I said to the gaffer, "You wanted us to go into that syndicate years ago, and we'd only have got 1/16. What was that all about?" When I go off like that, when I let loose, I'm in the zone. It's like I'm somebody else. It was almost a relief, some sort of freedom. Consequences were the last thing on my mind. I wasn't a Manchester United player now, or a professional footballer. I was a human being, fighting my corner. Now one player interrupted, or tried to take the heat out of it. Maybe because they'd seen how I'd responded to Edwin. They were all in quiet shock, I think. They felt they shouldn't have been in the room. Like we were neighbours arguing and they were looking over the wall at us going, "Next door, at it again." It was unfortunate for them. I said to the manager, "We need a bit more, gaffer. We're slipping behind other teams." And he said, "I've had enough of that." And I think he said, "Shut up." Something like that. I said, "Well, I've had enough of this meeting anyway. I'm fucking off. I'm going out to train." And I left the office. I went down the stairs. I turned round and I saw Mikhail Sylvester coming out, but he didn't follow me. Ole has since told me that when I left the room, the manager said, "Well, what about that?" According to Ole, Rio agreed with me that they played poorly at Middlesbrough. All the players started talking and Ole and Paul Scholes said they were leaving because they didn't want to talk about me when I wasn't there. I loved that. That showed me that bit of loyalty. When Ollie got up to leave, he was told by the manager, "Don't you follow him," in no uncertain terms. According to Ollie, Carlos called him into his office the next morning and told him to apologise to the manager for leaving the room or he'd be sacked. I went out to training, and eventually the rest of the players came down. It was Saipan Mark II. A heated discussion, nothing unusual in sport, and what should have been a private conversation, all out of control. There was probably no going back. I was beginning to feel like a dead man walking. I trained for a few days. Neither the manager nor Carlos was speaking to me. I was due to play in a reserve match at home to West Brom as part of my return from injury, and I was preparing for that. In the meantime, the club had sent me a letter. They were fining me £5,000 for my MUTV interview, and I appealed it. I spoke to my solicitor, Michael Kennedy, and I asked him to write a letter back. I'd been fined before and I'd never appealed. I just felt this time it was wrong. But I think that annoyed the manager. I think he thought I'd go, "Okay, I'll take my £5,000 and we'll move on." The team sheet for the West Brom game went up, but my name wasn't on it. I spoke to Rob Swire, the head physio, and I asked him, "Why haven't I in the team for the reserve match?" "Oh, the manager doesn't want you playing." So I went, "All right." I went up to his office and the bank away at the door. And he went, "Come in." What I loved more than anything else, and the manager would have known this, was playing. By not letting me play in the reserve match, he was preventing my recovery. The atmosphere in the room wasn't good. I said, "I'm supposed to be playing in the reserves. My recovery, you know." And he said, "No. You better speak to Michael Kennedy." It was Dave O'Leary who had put me in touch with Michael Kennedy when I was on my way to United back in 1993. Michael did that first deal with United, and every other deal for me, in and out of football, for more than 15 years. "Oh," I said. "All right." I went down and got into my car and I rang Michael. And he went, "Yeah, I've just had a call. They want me up on Friday." I said, "They're going to try and get rid of me. But they're trying to find me." "Yes, but that's not grounds for you moving on. Anyway, we'll see." I met Michael at Manchester Airport on the Friday morning. It was 18th November. He went, "What's all this about, Roy?" I just knew they were going to tell me it was time to move on. I was ready for it, but not prepared. We drove to the training ground for the meeting at about 9 o'clock. The manager was there in his office. David Gill, the chief executive, was there too. I hadn't been expecting him. I went, "So what's up?" And the manager said, "Look, Roy, I think we've come to the end." As simple as that. And Michael was going, "What? What's this? I thought this was just about the fine." Michael is a very good mediator and negotiator. They would be Michael's strengths. He's negotiated with top teams in Italy and with Real Madrid. He has vast experience. If I had done anything really bad, I'd have been fined 2 weeks' wages or even sacked. But a 5,000 fine was, in the bigger scale of things, nothing. So, from a 5,000 fine to what the manager had just said, Michael was nearly falling off his chair. But I said to the manager, "All right, yeah, I agree with you." Then David Gill said, "And while we're at it, we've prepared a statement." They had it all ready. It was another little hand grenade they threw at me. Not an hour later, or 2 hours, or after the severance negotiations, it was already written. Usually, I guess a player in my position would have been advised to say, "All right, I'll go. How much will you give me?" I'll fight my corner for money, but it wasn't the first thing that sprang to mind now. I could easily have said to Michael, "If Manchester United want me to go today, they fucking have to pay me." My reputation was ruined. It was going to be in shreds. But I wasn't thinking about my reputation or the PR side of things. I just thought, yeah, he's right. It's over. David Gill had a copy of the statement, and Michael leaned across and took it. We were both reading it when David Gill said, "By the way, Roy, you're also injured." And I went, "David, I broke my foot. My foot is broken from playing for Man United." I suppose the thinking was, let's try to get him out as quick as we can. Let's not drag this out till next week. This was Manchester United, one of the biggest media companies in the world. They spent a fortune on the image. And I was reading, "We'd like to thank Roy for his 11 and a half years at the club." But I'd been there 12 and a half years. And now I was thinking, the game is up. No problem with that. I'll fucking do it properly. I went, "You got 11 and a half years there." The two of them were looking at each other. And I said, "I've been here 12 and a half. "Oh, was it 12 and a half, Roy? "Oh, I wasn't sure. Was it 93 you came in? I can't remember." "Yeah," I said. "The first year we won the double." And David Gill said, "All right, we'll fix that." Michael was going, "I need to discuss this with my client." David Gill was, "Do you want 5 minutes together?" And we said, "All right." So they went out, the manager and David Gill, and left us alone. I said, "Come on, Michael, I've had enough of them. Fuck them. We've lost respect for each other." But Michael was going, "What? What are you talking about? I can't believe it. The contract? Your family?" He was emotional about it. He was upset. Also, I was his client, and he was probably thinking, this isn't right, this isn't fair. They came back in, and David Gill asked, "Is that enough time?" I said, yeah, I think you're right. We've come to the end, but I'm not sure about where do I stand in my contract. Can I play for another club straight away?" That was what I meant about being ready for this, but not prepared. It was the worst thing I'd done, or not done. I'd known for a few days that they were going to try and get rid of me. I could have rung the PFA, the Professional Footballers Association, and got legal advice. What were the consequences if my contract ended? There was the transfer window in January. This was November. Could I sign for another team immediately outside the transfer window? And if I signed, would I be allowed to play immediately? From my experience and for all the good advice I've given to people over the years, I hadn't taken heed of it myself. I said to Ferguson, "Can I play for somebody else?" And he said, "Yeah, you can, because we're tearing up your contract." The secretary's office was just across the corridor, and I thought, for just a second, before we shake hands and anything, or before I walk out or storm out, I'll go across to find out where I stand contractually. But it had gone too far. Deep down, I didn't give a shit. So I thought, "All right, I'll get fixed up. I knew there'd be clubs in for me when the news got out. I said, yeah, I think we have come to the end. Michael still couldn't believe it. I just thought, fucking pricks. And I stood up and went, yeah, I'm off. I left Michael to it. I got in there at about 9 o'clock. I think I was in my car by 9:45. Maybe it was my way of coping. Getting out as quickly as I could. Was it a childish way of coping? Was it my, I'd better get out of here before I fucking kill somebody way of coping? I don't know. I didn't want to see the players. They'd have all been coming in by then. I didn't want to be saying my goodbyes. So maybe it was just my immature way or mature way of dealing with it. I got into my car and drove out of the training ground. I pulled over just outside and cried for a couple of minutes. I just thought, it's over. I drove home. I kept thinking, we could have done this differently, surely. All this trivial stuff could have been managed much better. Not just by me, but by the manager and the club. There was a picture being painted that I was some sort of head case. If you were on the outside looking in, you'd be going, Saipan, now United, he is a head case. I was thinking about my family in Ireland. I knew what Cork was like. The news would be all over the place in 10 minutes. My family in Cork are big United fans. The effect on them was going to be massive. You'd have thought they'd have been used to it after Saipan. But my parents, was going to be torture for them. All that media intrusion again outside my house, outside my parents' house. People going, all right, he's gone off on one again. And I remember thinking too, while I was driving home, ah, I've got the club car here. I'll have to give it back. It was an Audi A8, and I really liked it. And I was going, I have to fucking give the car back. If I'd known more about the consequences, if I'd known that I wouldn't be able to play again until January, I would have stayed. I'd asked the manager if I could play for another club. This was the man I'd worked for 12.5 years. I'd like to think he'd have known his stuff. And I do think that he had a responsibility to know what he was letting me in for. Or he could have said, Roy, I'm not sure. You better ring the PFA before you leave here today. But he gone, yeah. Yeah, because we've torn your contract. When I got home, I rang the PFA and they said they'd look into it and they'd let me know after the weekend. That worried me. My head was spinning. Fucking hell, Roy, I thought. That was another clever decision. Walking out without my position properly clarified. Not that it would have changed my mind. I think I'd have gone about it the same way. I should have said, I'll train and Michael will do the negotiating. We'll see how it goes. And in the meantime, I'll ring the PFA. I would have been a good pro. I would have been awkward. I'd have done my training. But I also thought, the manager knows me. He might have said to David Gill, show him that statement to get my backup. He knew my character as well as anybody. The hours were going by. I was at home. Michael rang. Look, Roy, we're struggling here. They reckon there are cash flow problems in this. Ferguson has said since that they honoured the contract. But they didn't. I lost a lot of money that day. I was on £1 million incentive if I played in 50% of the season's games. I wouldn't be getting that now. They said they agreed a testimonial. But that had already been agreed months before. There was a confidentiality agreement, but I wasn't paid for that either. My silence cost them nothing. There was no benefit to me financially. They were going to pay my wages, but not in a lump sum. Just normal wages. I'd have liked whatever money I was due up front, a lump sum, instead of still being on the wage bill till the end of the season. A clean break. That would have been good. But Michael was now talking about cash flow problems. So I knew it wasn't going to happen. I remember saying to Michael, Michael, I'm not fucking interested in the money side of it. He came to my house later that afternoon. He was as white as a ghost. He still couldn't believe it. I said, "Michael, it's for the best." And he went, "Well, I believe you, Rye." I had to put up a front in front of Michael and my wife and family. I was the tough guy. I had to play the role that day, even though I'd been crying in the car a few hours earlier. I was trying to hide my hurt from my wife, although she'd have seen right through me. But there was also an element of relief. It was almost over. I said, "No, it's for the best." And actually, it was for the best. Whatever happened or was said afterwards, the timing was right. We'd come to the end. But I still don't know exactly why it happened. If the manager thought I'd been out of line with the Villa incident or the interview, he would surely have said to me quietly, "Look, Roy, be careful, you stepped out of line there, boy. You're out of order." He'd done that before when I'd been drinking or I'd been arrested or after I'd committed a bad tackle or when I'd chased the referee Andy Durso. There'd been times when he'd take me aside and say, "Hey, you fucking crossed the line there." And he'd have a go at me. I was his captain. I think back to Portugal and I wonder, was it that? The whole thing might have been a bit awkward, but I'd been looking after my family. It was no big deal. It was only a villa, the house we were going to stay in. As team captain, I'd always pushed for team spirit. Family get-togethers, the Christmas dues, match ticket for families, I'd sorted all that. Myself and my wife would get out of our way for any of the players, particularly the foreign lads. Then there was pre-season, and Carlos not wanting me back after I'd hurt my hamstring and thrown the bib at me. Was I missing something? Did Carlos see me as some sort of threat? And if so, did the manager feel he had to back him up? Carlos had been away at Real Madrid for a year and then he came back. He might have felt that I was a bigger presence in the dressing room, but I didn't go looking for that status. It comes with games, appearances, trophies. It just comes your way. But when Carlos came back, he might have felt, what's this guy about? Even though I'd worked with him previously and got on well with him. But I was intelligent enough to know that if the manager felt that this was between myself and Carlos, then he'd have to back his number two. I knew when I got into the argument with Carlos, when I said, "Do you make love to your wife in the same position?" I knew he wouldn't like it. To be honest, I didn't use the words "make love." I think I said, "When you shag your missus, do you change positions?" I think some of the lads were going, "Fucking hell, where did that come from?" In the heat of an argument, you go, "Here, you fucker." And you say things you might not normally say. And why did I bring up the horse syndicate with the manager? I'd like to know. But I wasn't going to sit back and be passive. You know, you fight your corner. I thought since that I should have insisted they show the interview on MUTV. I should have checked if I could do that legally. Show the video, because you're tarnishing me. You're making out I've said something really bad, and I haven't. Apparently I described Kieran Richardson as a lazy defender. But Kieran Richardson isn't the defender. Some players, out of position, defend lazily. They don't get back quickly enough. So the comment was taken out of context. I signed Kieran later when I managed Sunderland. I was critical of Darren Fletcher. Apparently, I doubted why people in Scotland raved about him. I might have said something like that, almost tongue-in-cheek. Sometimes you're rated more highly in your own country than you are in any other. I always rated Darren, and I used to push him. I think the lads I was really critical of were the ones I rated. I think you've got a chance of being a top player. I think you could do better. There's always a compliment in that. The players I didn't want to speak about, they were the ones who should have been worried. I went to Old Trafford not long ago. United played Liverpool in the League Cup. The first player to walk over and shake my hand was Darren Fletcher. Darren knew that I would have backed him to the hilt. A lot of the comments I've been expected to defend over the years, I'm not actually sure I made them. I'm supposed to have said about Rio Ferdinand something like, "Just because you're paid £100,000 a week and play well for England doesn't make you a top player." But I don't believe I ever said that. I don't think I've ever mentioned a player's wages in any interview in my life. And again, when we had that chat in the dressing room, Rio and Fletch were there. And they were the two I was supposed to have hammered. Fletch took me the way he knows me. And that was... I meant well. And remember, I said it all in an in-house studio. Could they not have edited the stuff they objected to? If they thought it was so bad that it had to be destroyed, why were they fining me £5,000? Why weren't they going a week's wages for that? You're bringing the club into disrepute. Or why didn't they just say quietly, we're not going to use it? I think the video, the interview, was just an excuse. It's been said that I brought up the Rock of Gibraltar affair, the manager's legal dispute with the horsey crowd, Magner and McManus, at the same time that he showed the video to the other players in his office. But I didn't. I'd had that conversation a couple of months earlier in private. Somebody I met in Ireland had told me to tell him, you are not going to win this. I mentioned it to him, and I told him I didn't think it was good for the club, the manager in a legal dispute with shareholders. I felt I was entitled to say that. He was just a mascot for them. Walking around with this Rock of Gibraltar, look at me, how big I am. And he didn't even own that bloody thing. I'd done an interview on MUTV earlier in the season, and I'd mentioned that, come the end of the season, it might be time for me to leave. This was after the Portugal incident. That might have annoyed the manager. He'd said before that when players got to 32 or 33, he'd discuss their contracts at the end of the season. He'd said it in a radio interview. I remember I was driving when I heard it. That irritated me a small bit, because other older players had signed deals well before the end of the season in the past. I felt as if I was back on trial. As for the idea that I thought of myself as the manager, it was nonsense. I knew my boundaries. I came into work every day and I did my best. And that included pushing the players. That was my job. Leading by example. I think it was one of my strengths. Pushing people and patting them on the back. I was the captain. I managed the dressing room. It was the job. When you become a manager and you speak to other managers, one of the first things they complain about is lack of that leadership out there amongst players. Nobody's taking the lead roles. They want the manager and the coach to play the game for them. I didn't. We had a good dressing room and we sorted out the problems. We tried to make the manager's job easier for him. I worked with top players, Ronaldo, Scholes, Laurent Blanc, when he came to United. I knew how to treat these men, how to speak to Laurent Blanc, a player I had massive respect for, or Darren Fletcher, a young Scottish lad, or John O'Shea, a young lad from Ireland. I knew how to speak to people in different ways. The Dutch boys, the arrogance of some of them, but I got on well with them. And we were winning trophies. There were good characters in that dressing room. Ferguson was clever enough to know that whenever I was gone, there'd be enough senior players and leaders still there. It wasn't going to crumble. Chelsea were strong at the time. They'd won the Premiership the season before, 2004-05, and that was going to continue. They were looking even stronger. Ferguson might have been looking at the team and thinking it needed a drastic change. He was rising to Mourinho's challenge. But when you're a player and a team like Chelsea come on the scene, and this is a personal point of view, you're 33 or 4, you start to think, I'm past it. I'm not like the player I was. But Ferguson wasn't an aging player. He'd just have seen it as a challenge. Things were changing. Rio had come to the club, and Ronaldo and Rooney, all decent lads, top players. But the game was changing slightly as well. I would make a point about the lads being on their phones and their PlayStations. Come on, lads. This is a dressing room, you know? Maybe that was me being an old fuddy-duddy. I don't know. They were younger than me. I knew I wouldn't miss the players that much when I left. I'd miss them, but there was no one in there who'd make me go, oh, he was one of my best pals. Those men had left. That's what happens with football clubs. Different characters come and go. My leaving the club, the way I look at it now, it was definitely for the benefit of Manchester United. If the manager and Carlos felt that I was up to whatever they thought I was up to, if there was that awkwardness, Then it was best for everybody that I go. And let me suffer the consequences. Let me cry in my car for 2 minutes. If it benefited Manchester United, so be it. I think it was for the best. Not from a football point of view, the playing side of it, I still could have contributed. I could look after my body. They knew my body as well as anybody, who would have played fewer games. But from a club point of view, if they felt I had crossed that line, and again, I don't think I did, then it was for the best. Forget about payments and statements. When the paperwork had finally been sorted and I'd given back the car, this was 3 months after the last meeting, so I got an extra 3 months out of it. I drove some fucking miles in that car. Every little victory is vital. I went to see the manager and Carlos, and I apologised. But now I kind of wish I hadn't. Sometimes you feel a justified anger. Sometimes you feel you've done something wrong. I apologised. Listen. But afterwards I was thinking, I'm not sure why I fucking apologised. I just wanted to do the right thing. I was apologising for what had happened, that it had happened. But I wasn't apologising for my behaviour or stance. There's a difference. I had nothing to apologise for. There probably isn't a good way to leave a club. But is it always the player's fault? It can't be. A lot of people left United on bad terms. Good players. Beckham, Van Nistelrooy, plenty of other names. Deep down, I might have accepted that it was not going to end well. Whether it was the video, or if we didn't have any trophies at the end of the season, or if my contract wasn't renewed, it was coming to an end. I was getting older. But I think the best way the manager could have dealt with it, given his experience and man-management skills, would have been to take me aside and go, listen, Roy, we're having issues with you, but keep your head down, play a few games, and come the end of the season, we'll say that it was best for you to go. Not in mid-November, when I'd been injured and I couldn't play for another team until January. It wouldn't have been champagne and, oh, he's leaving. But they would have shown a bit of class. And they didn't show it. I loved everything about United. From the day I signed for them. I just think it suited my personality. I loved the team. I loved the way we played. I liked all the lads. I liked the training. I liked the way we travelled. I liked the pressure. I liked the United fans. I thought they were pretty switched on, even when we lost. They'd be going mad, but a nice mad. I liked the demands, the kit, the badge, the history. I liked living in Manchester. I got on well with the manager. There was trust there, a big word in football. I liked the staff, everyone at the training ground, the groundsmen. The different coaches over the years, Brian Kidd, Jim Ryan, Steve McLaren, Walter Smith, Carlos Quiros, Mickey Phelan, and winning. I enjoyed the winning. I still have that soft spot for United, and thank God I do. I took my son to the Champions League final between Bayern and Dortmund at Wembley in 2013. He was going on about different teams, and I asked him, which team do you support? He said, United. He would have known I still had that little bit of resentment. So I said, why do you support United? And he said, well, I was born in Manchester and I'm not going to support City, am I? I said, okay. That was a good enough reason. And I thought to myself, I better get us some season tickets. We went to see them recently and I was going, come on! Fucking hell, come on! I want them to do well. When I moved to Celtic, I used to get an early flight up to Edinburgh or Glasgow and I'd hire a car and drive from there to the training ground. I'd stay a couple of days up there. One morning, a taxi driver picked me up to bring me from my house to Manchester Airport. I got into the taxi at about 6. My flight was at 7. In the middle of winter, and the taxi driver asked me, do you miss being at United? It was 6 in the fucking morning. It was freezing. Black outside. I looked at them and I went, What do you think? We laughed.
5.
I lay on the bed, and my hip, I'd never known pain like it. My hip was fucking screaming. I was going for bike rides around where I live, trying to keep fit. I'd no one to train with, in terms of kicking a ball and twisting and turning, the type of work I needed after being out injured. I was even kicking a ball against my garage door. Inside the garage, striking the ball against the door. It was like being a kid again, back in Mayfield, kicking a ball against a wall. I'd a punch bag in the garage too, and a skipping rope. I'd do some skipping. And I'd do a few press-ups. It was basic boxing training. Anything to make me feel a bit better. Michael Kennedy started ringing me. There were clubs interested in talking. I'd have choices. But instead of enjoying it all, I was thinking, I'm starting all over again. Back to the beginning. But another part of me thought, a new dressing room. I learned something a bit different. But I wished I'd had a few games under my belt. I hadn't played for 5 or 6 weeks, and I couldn't play again until January. It wasn't ideal. People at a new club might think, we're signing fucking Maradona, because of what I'd done at United. Real Madrid offered me a 1.5-year deal. Everton on my doorstep wanted me to go to them. I met their manager, David Moyes, at his house, and I was impressed by what he said. Bolton, also on my doorstep. I met with Sam Allardyce too. But I went to Celtic for 15 grand basic a week. I know it was a lot of money, but I'd been earning a lot more. It was a massive pay cut. When a club is interested in you, the manager generally sells it to you. Listen, we'd love to have you here. But I met Gordon Strachan, the Celtic manager in London. I met him in the majority shareholder Dermot Desmond's house. And Gordon told me, I'm not really too worried if you sign for us or not. We're okay without you. So I said to myself, fuck him, I'm signing. I think it was one of the reasons I signed for them. To prove Gordon wrong. To be fair to Gordon, they were doing well in the league and he already had Neil Lennon playing in my position. And Stylian Petrov. He had a good team. So I wasn't sitting back, shocked, going, show me the love. I thought, all right, that's the game. He was letting me know they weren't desperate for me. He was being a bit coy, and I was fine with that. But there was a bit of defiance there too, like, you might be 15 points clear, but if I join, you might go 20 points clear. You might even need me next year in Europe. Michael had been over to Madrid, and he'd negotiated a deal with Real. They spoke to me too. Butragueño rang me. Emilio Butragueño. What a player he was. Michael had given me a heads up that Butragueño would be phoning. So I took my mobile everywhere with me. And, how's your luck? He rang me when I was sitting on the toilet. He said, look, Roy, we'll be glad to have you. The club's board just had to sanction the deal. It was standard procedure. I was going, okay, hesitating. Michael was going, what are you doing, Roy? Then Real needed time to rubber stamp the deal. This was a few weeks before Christmas, and I just ran out of patience. I should have appreciated Real's offer more. It was the most attractive challenge in front of me, but I didn't accept it. With hindsight, I should have said to myself, go. Go to Spain. Live there for 1.5 years, learn a different language, learn the culture. You might end up loving it. You might even stay there. I took a negative approach, I think, instead of saying, this is amazing, what a chance for me. It could have been great for my kids. The weather and the training might have given me another lease of life, another 2 years of playing. I might have picked up new techniques from my stretching. But instead, as usual, I was looking at what might go wrong. Hindsight is a fucker of a word. At the time, it felt like the right decision. I didn't want to move to Spain. As much as anything else, it was fear that decided me. Fear of the unknown. And I threw excuses in front of me. Family, language, the kids' education. I could imagine myself going to Madrid and into the dressing room. I'd be starting all over again, and I was in no mood to be doing that. I'd had a tough career. Physically, I was struggling.
It's no good playing for a club, or it's not just about playing for them. It's about having an effect on the club, having a big influence.
That was one of my concerns when I left United. I was 34, an experienced player. Real Madrid might just have wanted someone to do a job, sit in the middle of the park for a few games. But I wanted to go in and have an effect on the team.
Yes, it was Real Madrid, but to me football is still the same. Doesn't matter about the level.
Would I go back to Cove Ramblers next week?
No, because I wouldn't be able to affect the team.
When I hear people say, I played for United or I played for Sheffield Wednesday, lots of men have played for these clubs, but it's about affecting them, affecting their history, having an impact.
Some of the top players can do that. Rooney, Ronaldo, Messi,
or Cantona, and at Forest, Stuart Pearce, all top players who had an effect in their different ways.
I could affect games with my presence, by breaking play up, imposing myself, even in the tunnel, before we went onto the pitch.
But I was 34, and I played a hard, physical game. I'd watched older players going to new clubs, and it hadn't worked out.
Actually, it wasn't really about which club I should go to. Forget about Madrid, Everton, Celtic, Barcelona, Inter Milan, and the reasons I should or shouldn't have gone to any of them. The fact is, the morning I left United, I lost the love for the game a little bit. I could have had every club in the world ringing me, but it wouldn't have given me that buzz, that satisfaction, that here we go. I thought I could make a bigger impact at Celtic than I would have at Everton or Madrid. To be honest, I thought it might be a bit easier at Celtic. I knew they would dominate a lot of matches. I'll go up to Celtic and I'll maybe do a job for a year and a half. But when I arrived, I still felt like I was starting all over again, trying to prove people wrong.
I signed for Celtic on the 15th of December, although I couldn't play until January. The press conference was chaotic the day I signed. I felt like putting a dampener on it. Listen, lads, I'm 34, my hip's hanging off. Outside Celtic Park, with a scarf over my head for the photographs, hundreds of fans on the steps of the stadium. They were really good to me. They gave me a great welcome, everybody at the club. And it was nice to get the Celtic kit on. I was glad to be there. They were letting me get back to what I was about, playing football. And Gordon Strachan and his staff, Gary Pendry and, of course, Tommy Burns. There was a very good atmosphere, good banter. Tommy was a really good guy, God rest his soul. If I'd gone to Madrid, I would never have met Tommy. John Clark, the kit man, was one of the Lisbon Lions. He was part of the team that won the European Cup in 1967. The kit man is vital. He's almost the hub of everything, a link to everybody. He has to be good-humoured and upbeat. You have to be glad to see the kit man in the morning. He reflects the club, in a sense. I think Clarkey got a bigger buzz out of me signing for Celtic than anybody else at the club. He appreciated what I'd done in the game. He couldn't do enough for me. I met great people up at Celtic. Their training, particularly their warm-ups, it was all about rotational stuff, movement of the hips. First and foremost, there was always a ball. If there were 16 players, there'd be 8 serving the ball to 8 players in the middle. You'd always be working on the ball. And your recovery was when you were the server. You'd be throwing the ball for somebody in the middle. It was all about flicking the ball back with the outside of your foot or your instep. All rotational stuff. The stressful part for me was flicking the ball back. And that was only the warm-up. After the warm-up, I felt like going in. I was thinking, that's me done. I'm struggling. But I actually liked it, getting a feel for the ball. And there was a bit of banter thrown in, because some lads couldn't do it. So I enjoyed all that. But my hip didn't. I hadn't trained properly, with the ball and other players, in more than 2 months. Knocking the ball against the garage door is no substitute. We trained for an hour and a quarter, or an hour and a half. I didn't feel too bad immediately afterwards. It was all new. I had that extra bit of energy. I got back to my hotel in Edinburgh. people had advised me to stay in Edinburgh. Live in Edinburgh, keep away from all the hassle.